This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have David V. Hill.
Hey.
And Rufaro Manyepa.
Hello.
Joining us from Wisconsin is Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Well, the big story this week is that Turkey is currently in the midst of an offensive in Syria against the Kurds that were a crucial ally of the U.S. for the last several years in its fight against the Islamic State. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go to Brent.
The United States announced once again that it has decided to leave Syria. And this comes at a really difficult time, obviously, because the Syrian civil war, while that is dying down, the United States forces were embedded with the Kurds. These are an ally, as Jeremiah said, that have been working together with the United States, actually providing a lot of the fighting force the United States uses to fight against the Islamic State inside Syria. And the United States, under President Trump, has decided that it's time for him to pull out the troops. And following that decision, we had Turkey now having a ground offensive and an air offensive into Syria to really take down the Kurds, who have been this United States ally for so long. And this is one of the reasons why the United States has stayed there embedded with the Kurds, because they knew that the United States knows that Turkey is very upset with these the Kurdish national, or the Kurds on the Syrian side of the border that are allied with the United States, basically protecting them from Turkish attack. And now that the United States has decided to wind down its forces further, Turkey is making the most of the opportunity. And it seems like the United States has backtracked on its position that saw the Kurdish fighters that it had fighted with as not being a terrorist entity, as being legitimate holders of the land there in northern Syria. Turkey, of course, has called the Kurds terrorists all the time. Because they're backing out, the United States has virtually allowed Turkey to come in and gobble up some territory of northern Syria that the Kurds currently occupy and push back the Kurdish ambition for a future homeland in northern Syria. The Kurds, of course, are not a people that have a country themselves. There's about 22 million Kurds that live in northern Syria, eastern Turkey, northern Iraq, and northern Iran. And the Kurds basically saw, at least the Kurds on the Syrian side, saw this fight against the Islamic State as a growth in its legitimacy to become a state itself, because it had the backing of the United States in northern Syria. Now that the United States is leaving, they've basically green-lighted Turkey's ambition to bring down the Kurds in northern Syria.
So some Pentagon officials have voiced concerns that this incursion could lead to the release of, I think it's some 12,000 Islamic State terrorists that are presently imprisoned or being held, and possibly even to the return of, you know, the caliphate the Islamic State was working to establish. Do you think there's validity to those concerns?
Well, of course there is. I mean, the Kurds right now, as you said, they are looking over and holding about 12,000, as you said, Islamic State fighters in prisons. They are the prison guards, and they are keeping them at bay until, you know, their fate is decided. But now you have the Kurds that are having to fight a massive army. I think Turkey's like the eighth largest army, or has the eighth largest military in the world, and they're going to have to turn their guns now to try and focus on Turkey coming in. And what the Kurds have said is, what do you want us to do? You want us to fight against Turkey, or do you want us to keep the Islamic State in prisons? It's basically your choice. And what the President Trump has said is that, really, if Turkey goes in there hard against the Kurds, then they have to try and make sure that these Islamic State soldiers stay in prison and that they are contained. But there is great motivation for the Kurds, even at this point, to show the world that we have fought against Islamic State on your side for so long, and if we're having to fight against Turkey, then what choice do we really have?
So what do you think this decision by the U.S. president shows, you know, not just our allies in the Middle East, but really the world, about the reliability of America and its alliances.
Well, it shows that President Trump will have his way wherever it is, and in terms of the foreign policy of the United States. He said back in December 2018, we are out of Syria. Then you had all the generals come down and say, no way, don't do it. We can't get out of eastern Syria. We're worried that the Kurds, our allies that we've fought with for so long, are going to be attacked by Turkey, which is happening. We're worried that the Islamic State, if we leave, could resurface, which may happen. We're worried that Iran is going to actually fill the vacuum that is created from our withdrawal, which is happening as well right now. Iran has announced its own drills on the Turkish border, Turkish border right now, with the Iranian side. So they're interested in this as well. And so President Trump has basically given his generals, I feel, the past 10 months to find a solution, because he said, okay, fine, we won't pull out of eastern Syria. But now here we are 10 months later, and he says we are doing it. Now, this is interesting for a couple of reasons, I think. As we wrote at the time, we wrote an article, America is backing out, showing that America's place in the Middle East is as the guarantor of peace. Relative peace is no longer applicable. That can't, if the United States is not going to stand by the Kurds or its other allies, then it really does. That was a great deterrence against other nations fighting against the Kurds, or even fighting against Israel, the threat of United States actions. And if the United States can't be relied on to stand by one of its allies, then it seems to just up the tension in the Middle East going forward, because there are other state actors that want to jump on that territory, and even the role that the United States has filled in the region, be that Russia, Iran, Turkey, or possibly even Europe. Now, Europe itself, they have come out and said strongly against Turkey. They are not for Turkey's ground offensive into another country against the Kurds. They want Turkey to stop. But President Erdogan came out and said, hey, if you don't be quiet, basically said, if you label what we're doing as an occupation of Syria, we've got 3.6 million refugees right now in Turkish Turkish camps and such. We're free to send them north. He said, quote, we will open the gates and send 3.6 million refugees your way. That's what he said today to Europe. And so Europe has a vested interest in, I'd say, not allowing Turkey to release those migrants. But at the same time, Europe doesn't really favor what Turkey is doing in Syria. So maybe President Trump is like, we've had enough, and we're going to let those that actually have an interest in fighting the Islamic State, those that are on the receiving end of the Islamic State, be that Europe or be that Turkey, to end up and going to fight there themselves, and we're pulling out. So this actually might motivate a bit of European action, as President Trump has wanted, to try and become that guarantor of the Kurds, protector of the Kurds, because Europe right now is allied with the Kurds also inside northern Syria, inside Iraq. And President Trump has made this decision without really talking with and working with the allies about what's going to happen after they leave. And so this might motivate a European entrance, which is something we've been watching for. Bible prophecy talks a lot about Europe finally entering the Syrian fray, and an entrance by Turkey into the arena could motivate a European decision to come down there and finally replace the United States as the guarantor of peace for the Kurds, protection for the Kurds, and also perhaps to finally counter what Iran is doing in eastern Syria as well.
What piece of literature would you recommend to listeners who would like to study into the prophetic context of that?
Well, we haven't actually written up this story yet, as it's still breaking, but I think that they can go back and read the story from last year, which basically analyzed the same situation taking place right now. It's entitled America is Backing Out.
America is Backing Out. We'll be sure to leave a link to that in our show notes for today's episode. Thanks very much for that, Brent. So the Turks are seizing Kurdish territory, and in Europe this week, there has also been a campaign underway to take territory, though it's been, you know, it's being done in a more subtle way, at least at this point. To tell us about this, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, Germany is being accused of trying to annex Northern Ireland. This is the latest chapter in the Brexit saga. Basically, how we got here is that You know, all along, Europe has said, well, one of our big concerns with Brexit is we want there to be no hard border in Northern Ireland. They've said, you know, that there's been conflict in that area. We've gotten things to settle down. It almost feels like one country right now because there isn't a hard border. It's easy to pass back and forward. So there's no passport checks there. There's no customs checks. So whatever solution we work out after Brexit, there's got to be no hard border. So this week, or well, starting towards the end of last week, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson unveiled his latest proposal for what to do with Brexit. And it met what the EU wanted. It said, okay, well, you want no hard border. Here's a proposal for that. So the Northern Ireland will stay in the same kind of zone and accept EU rules when it comes to agriculture and a few certain areas where, you know, if you're an island and you share an island, to get a fairly small island together, it does help to have common rules on things like agriculture. But then it says, well, because we're giving Europe jurisdiction in these areas, you know, we believe in democracy, it believes in democracy, so we need to put this to the voters. And so the Northern Ireland Assembly in Stormont will have to give their approval for this. We can't, you know, submit people to other laws and regulations without their consent. So that's the deal. They can stay in some of these areas, and then Northern Ireland would come out of the customs zone. But again, his proposal had details about how there wouldn't actually be custom checks on the border. All kind of importing and exporting would be taken care of away from the border so that there was still no hard border. So this met everything that the EU said they wanted and they said they were concerned about. And then German Chancellor Angela Merkel moved the goalposts. It made it completely apparent that this demand for no hard border in Northern Ireland wasn't out of any kind of concern for the peace process, but was just an excuse to try and force Britain to remain under European jurisdiction. So what she did, there was a phone call between her and the Prime Minister Boris Johnson earlier in the week. And according to a leaked report from Number 10 Downing Street, she said that the only option was that the UK cannot leave without leaving Northern Ireland behind in a customs union and in full alignment forever. So she was basically saying, okay, well, Britain, you can leave the European Union, but this chunk of the UK, Northern Ireland, it must submit to our rules and regulations for a whole load of these different areas forever. Without their consent, they have to submit. And that's the only way we're going to get a deal. And this got quite the reaction. Like I said, people were accusing her of effectively trying to annex Northern Ireland because, well, that's, you know, unilaterally trying to keep a chunk of somebody else's country in your country pretty much effectively does that. Douglas Carswell wrote about it in today's Telegraph. He said, Berlin, now the real center of power in the European Union, has no intention of seeing Northern Ireland escape the backstop. And basically, he explains that this whole situation, Europe knows that the UK isn't going to leave Northern Ireland behind. So if they can keep Northern Ireland as a hostage under EU rules, the whole rest of the UK will probably end up submitting to these UK rules. So Northern Ireland's not left by itself. But anyway, he says, EU strategy has been to seek the de facto annexation of UK territory. They've done so in order to bind us into a customs union. Now, Europe has kind of stepped back a little from this position over the last couple of days. I think they realized just how bad it looked, and they don't want to be the ones seen as getting the blame for any subsequent no deal. And I think it, you know, became very quickly apparent that no British government could ever let itself be bossed around like that. So it seems like they might have stepped back a little. But again, I don't think that's because of a genuine desire to do a deal. I think it's because if things go south, they don't want to get the blame for there not being one.
So October 31st is rapidly approaching. What do you think we can expect now that we're in this crunch time with Brexit?
So the schedule for the next few days is, in theory, Europe and the UK are going to work on trying to get a deal together. And they want to get it so that they can finalize that deal at a EU heads of government meeting, or heads of state, whichever, whoever in which country holds the biggest hat, on October 17th and 18th. So they'll be meeting, and that's when they're meant to hash out the final deal. Parliament will be sitting on October 19th, the first time that Parliament sat on a Saturday since the Falklands War, where they'll kind of go over the deal. In theory, if there's no deal by then, that's when things get really interesting. That the Parliament has passed a law saying Mr. Johnson has to request an extension. He said that there's no way he's going to accept an extension. The latest news from Europe was saying they want a commitment to a second referendum. If they're going to offer an extension, or they want fresh elections. And then I think just today, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party, have indicated that they would only allow fresh elections after a second referendum. So if there's no deal, that's where things are going to get really interesting. But that's the schedule for the next couple of weeks.
Could you place all of this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just let listeners know what they could read to understand it in that context?
Yeah, I think the big part of this story is it just really exposes the European Union and it exposes Germany for what they are. You've got this, if it was a trading relationship, like they've always claimed to be, and Britain saying, hey, we joined this trading club, we want to leave this trading club. I mean, normally clubs don't take hostages when people try to leave them. It exposes just that domineering aspect of the European Union. They've cooked up this whole strategy to try and find a way, I think, to keep Britain subject to a whole lot of European Union rules. And I think what they want to do is have Britain out of the European Union so they can't hold up things like a push for a European military and some of those pushes to integration, but that they're still subject to European laws. And so that European unions still are in charge and still dominate. So it just exposes Europe's urge to dominate, and more accurately, it exposes Germany. I mean, all of this was coming from a phone call with the German chancellor. It's the German chancellor, Angela Merkel, that really calls all the shots. The former UK prime minister, David Cameron, he made that abundantly clear in his memoirs he published a few weeks ago. He talked about his negotiations with the European Union and about how, and he talked quite freely in there about how it really was. Angela Merkel was in charge and she didn't really have Britain's interests at heart. So it exposes this will to dominate, exposes the character of Europe, which makes complete sense when you understand Bible prophecy, because the Bible reveals that this European Union is a resurrection of a European empire that has risen up repeatedly in Europe. Revelation chapter 17 talks about this empire that rises up seven times, this empire that is led by a church, led by the Catholic Church. It's written by a woman in Revelation chapter 17, the symbol for a church. We've seen this empire rise, you know, anciently under things like the Emperor Justinian and Charlemagne. We've seen it more recently in leaders like Napoleon and Adolf Hitler. You know, what we're seeing is a resurrection of that empire. And of course, all of these empires have slightly different characteristics, but this will to dominate is consistent across all of them. And to understand this empire, to really, you know, prove that these scriptures do talk about a modern European power, to prove that these scriptures did prophesy all of those other powers, then I'd really urge you to read our free book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? That will really expose what these scriptures are talking about and what the Bible says about the news that we see every day coming out of Europe.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. For our next story, we'll take a look at China, where the leadership is telling people how to think, not just in China and not just even in the weaker nations in the Chinese periphery, but all the way across the Pacific in one of America's most visible cultural institutions. To tell us about this, we'll turn it over to David.
Thank you. So last Saturday, Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted support for the Hong Kong protesters, and China responded very aggressively, cutting off ties with the NBA, saying that it hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. And in response, basically, the network carrying NBA games said they would stop airing Rockets games, and sponsors from China started to pull back their sponsorships with the NBA. And then this caused reaction. So the Rockets player James Harden tweeted basically saying he apologized and that we love China. The Rockets owner said Moore didn't speak for the team, and even the league commissioner said that it was regrettable what was tweeted out. But then this got a backlash in the United States, and some politicians got involved. And I think one of the interesting things about this story is that's one of the few things the right and the left agree on and thought that the NBA was being very hypocritical. So the NBA league commissioner released another statement, and they basically said, well, and this was Adam Silver, the commissioner there, they backtracked and said they wouldn't regulate what their players said. So this kind of elevated the spat, and now you have China taking down some ads from the NBA over there. And you even had an instance where a couple in a preseason game in Philadelphia holding signs of basically free Hong Kong, they were evicted from the game there. And that was a preseason game between the Sixers and a Chinese team, the Lions. I'm not even going to pronounce the city that they came from, and their Chinese Basketball Association. So all of this came from a tweet, and I think is very interesting too, because Twitter is banned in China. So I'm not sure how many feelings were actually hurt from what Maury wrote there. But I think what a lot of people probably, we don't really think about a whole lot, is that China really does aggressively get United States companies to follow their censor regulations. And I don't think a lot of people are aware of that. But now you have the NBA being involved in this spat, and it's right at the American culture. So I think this is one of the first instances where you really have a big awareness in the public for how China deals with United States companies in their trade relations. And I think because of that, that it's actually going to have a bigger impact in the long run as the culture kind of catches up to what's going on. You're going to have an outcry, I think, from the American public, and it's going to make it harder for the United States companies to continue to deal with China and to follow the regulations that they impose on them, just repressing free speech or whatever China asks them to do. And that's just going to elevate the trade spat between China and the United States.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that the the NBA has really tried to portray itself as kind of the wokest professional sports league in some ways, and it's at least tried to depict itself as that. But now you see the NBA kind of either being exposed as being only aware and concerned about American politics and social issues, or as just being, you know, very easily bought. So it does seem like it would exert some pressure, not just on this particular athletic institution, but also on a lot of American culture.
Yeah, and I think it's going to spread to other sports networks too. I know like the NFL is trying to beef up its relationship with China. I think even the NBA, there's talk or some plans, potentially some Chinese team being involved. So there's a lot of money to be had in the Chinese market. These companies are trying to grow their audience, and it's forced them to put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, and really buckle down and see if they're going to champion what really is an American idea and values over the money that China would give to them.
And it's not just sports teams either.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is what a lot of people don't realize is this has been going on for a long time. So you have Facebook was involved in creating like a censorship apparatus in its app, and then they were fine with that, but then kind of the deal with Facebook kind of fell, so they backed off from it. But you have instances with Apple removing some flags, and they've been involved a lot with China. They're probably the most susceptible one there. And then you even have examples of like newer apps like TikTok, where they are fully embracing the whatever China wants them to censor. So you have a lot of companies just basically doing whatever China tells them to do. And a lot of people don't realize that, or they don't think about it. And I think that's why this story is kind of bigger than normal, because Americans care about their basketball. So if you get an issue that the Americans really believe in and they get upset, then that's going to force all of these companies to start evaluating whether or not they can keep doing that. And that's just going to make the relationship a lot harder. And it's so crazy too, because a lot of the tech companies were involved in building the apparatus. So we had this whole idea that internet would help free China and bring those ideas of freedom and human rights to the Chinese people. And instead, what you see now is like the importing of Chinese censorship ideas to United States. It's had the opposite effect, and what we thought would happen hasn't happened. And for a large reason, it's because our engineers here helped China build those big censorship walls.
Yeah, it really does show just how incredibly powerful the Chinese Communist Party is, that they can be dictating policy, you know, all the way in the United States, probably the country that they view as their biggest adversary, and here they are implementing thought control on some of our most vaunted institutions. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy?
Yes, so we know that the Bible prophesies about a siege coming, an economic siege against America, where the nations basically refuse to trade and sell goods with the United States and Israel, the other Israelite nations, and that this siege is going to be the trigger, the starting point for what the Bible calls the Great Tribulation as well. And you can see those prophecies in Ezekiel 4 and Deuteronomy 28, verse 52. What you have is basically a very small step towards that, where the Chinese government, or the Chinese government, is basically already starting to boycott certain aspects of the United States economy because they refuse to bow down to their censorship rules. And while the prophecies show that the siege will be led by Europe, we know that China will form a very big part of this, as it is United States' largest trade partner. So it is a pretty big deal, prophetically speaking.
And what would you recommend as far as literature goes?
Well, I think to get the full picture and the whole story, because that the economic siege is one part of a big series of prophecies of what's happening in Israel, I would suggest everyone order the Ezekiel booklet, and it'll put that siege into proper prophetic context and give the whole story of why it's happening and what the punishment is for, and the other very dramatic events that happen surrounding the siege as well.
Well, thanks very much for that, David. For the next story, we'll take a look at the U.S., where the radical left's war against biology, which they say they are waging in the name of freedom, is ruining many lives. To tell us about this, we'll go to Rufaro.
Yes, well, basically, a woman named Charlie Evans identified as a man for about 9 years, almost a decade, before she decided to detransition. And this was basically because she realized that she wasn't getting happier as she thought she would after having transitioned to becoming a transgender. And after that, she came into contact with quite a few people who, just like her as well, did not see any positive effect coming from her becoming a transgender. And it's just opened up a whole new conversation, because it's something that has never really been explored before. And it's essentially coming from people suffering from gender dysphoria. And this is a condition called by the National Health Service in Britain as one where people are distressed or discomforted or unhappy because of their gender. And this mainly comes because the NHS itself says that everyone is born either belonging to the male or female sex. But as far as gender is concerned, gender is malleable. It's something that can change. You can be born of the male sex, but your gender can be something different thereafter. And that is really the trigger of this, because when people start having that gender dysphoria, they then start having the only solution that's being touted to them to get out of this distress and unhappiness is being transitioning and becoming a transgender, which is exactly what happened with Charlie Evans herself. But she turned away from that and realized that it actually wasn't making her happy. And ever since she did that, she went public with her story, and she says that she's encountered hundreds of people who similarly have been disillusioned by this touted solution to the unhappiness that people feel. And I think it's particularly interesting that the way that transgenderism actually starts is it's mainly targeting people who are really young. And Charlie Evans herself says that the main people that she's encountered who were disillusioned in such a manner are 18, 19, 20-year-olds. And if you look at the way that the movement actually is being pushed, it's mainly, you know, public readings by transgenders at libraries, doctors encouraging young people to explore their gender options. You have pro-transgender curricula being introduced in schools, and you even have the NHS itself offering gender identity services to children as young as 3 years old, you know. So it's starting with the young people. And a Brown University study then showed that thereafter, the gender dysphoria actually becomes a problem with young people, because once they get this indoctrination of transgenderism as being something that's good, they then begin to basically be in an echo chamber where they are all influencing each other and convincing each other that the solution to any problems that they have is transitioning to being a transgender. So basically, all these people who are pushing the transgender movement just introduce it to children when they are young, and then thereafter, the children convince themselves that transitioning is the only viable solution.
So these are you know, very young people who are not at all equipped yet with powers of judgment or discernment that are needed to make higher level decisions of any kind, really. And so they're utterly dependent on authorities to help them if they begin to struggle with anything they may encounter, really, and particularly if they're struggling with something as difficult as this dysmorphia that you're describing here. And so they need the authorities to tell them, embrace your biology and we can help you do that in these ways. But instead, the authorities are increasingly telling them to go in just the opposite direction, which is this story here shows that that's just leading to a lot of shattered lives.
Exactly. It's the authorities aren't even really helping them. And the main problem is that there actually hasn't been a study into seeing how many people are even content with being transgender or their transition. They're not looking into whether or not there are people who are suffering as a consequence. You know, they're just on the opposite. They're just pushing and introducing more incentives for people to become transgender. And I think this story is really important because even though there's no study per se, which is looking into the people who are disillusioned by transgenderism, it's showing that those people actually do exist. And you think this is just one person who decided to go forward with her story and share it with people, and she's managed to have it resonate with so many people. And even the fact that she has said that some of the people that she's spoken to have said that after they went public or after they told people that they weren't happy with being transgender and that their gender dysphoria hadn't been solved by it, they were shunned by the LGBT community. They felt ostracized. They were, in some cases, attacked and silenced for actually saying that they're not happy with this. It just shows that the entire movement is not really helping anybody at all, but it's just causing more and more misery to just go through. And finally, we're starting to see some evidence of that happening.
What would you recommend to listeners who would like to learn about this in the prophetic, biblically relevant context?
Well, essentially, the Bible does speak about just how God created human beings. And Genesis 1:27 says he created us male and female. And in Deuteronomy 22, it even condemns the idea of men wearing women's clothing and women wearing men's clothing. And it just like shows how people breaking those laws today are being unhappy, because when you break those laws that was put in place, you really do become happy. But if people obey the laws that God put in place, then they will be happy. Proverbs 29 verse 18 says that he who keeps the law, happy is he. And the opposite of that is what's happening in society today. So just for people to find out more about this, Mr. Hilliker has an excellent article on the website titled Transgenderism and the Pursuit of Happiness, just showing that how it's not at all a viable solution into people actually becoming happier. And even his booklet, even our booklet titled Redefining Family, is an excellent source for just understanding how all these movements of transgenderism and that have gripped the world today are just leading us into misery and unhappiness.
We'll be sure to include links to both that article and that booklet in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Rifaro. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon, along with links to the literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. Coming up, we're going to talk about anti-Semitic attacks in Germany, an update on the Israeli election, China's plans for U.S. satellites, and a dangerous new law in Scotland. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In Europe this week, on the holiest day of the Jewish year, a man opened fire outside of a synagogue. To tell us about this gut-wrenching attack, we'll go once again to Richard.
Yes, a 27-year-old man, Stephen B., his name has been released as, killed two people, injured two more in an attack on a synagogue in the city of Halle in the state of Saxony-Anhalt. So shortly after 1 p.m., he began this attack. To me, one of the most striking things about it is, you know, there was the potential for this to have been a whole lot more lethal than it was. I mean, obviously, two deaths and two injuries in an attack like this is tragic. But it came pretty close to being a lot worse. He tried to get into the synagogue, but I guess people had spotted him with the gun or whatever. They barricaded the door. If you've seen any synagogues in Europe, you know, they tend to have the bars over the windows and all of this. So with the door barricaded, he couldn't get in. So he did shoot a woman outside the synagogue at a Jewish cemetery that was near there. He then left an improvised explosive device at the synagogue. That didn't go off. And then he drove to a Turkish kebab shop and he killed someone else there. And then the whole thing he live streamed on the Amazon kind of game streaming platform Twitch. So, but anyway, the Deutsche Welle noted, well, they had a subhead, technical failures save lives. And they wrote that the shooter used multiple weapons, including homemade bombs and what appeared to be a homemade rifle. He experienced repeated technical failures during the attack, which ultimately saved lives. He talked about a man who stopped his vehicle outside the synagogue to kind of see what was going on, and the guy pointed the gun at him, pulled the trigger, and it failed to fire. So, you know, this was the potential to be a massive, massive attack here. Now, sadly, these kind of attacks, though, are becoming more and more common in Europe. It's every few months, I guess, that we're talking about a deadly attack. There's just a really common thread of attacks that don't end up being deadly, but still have got to be disquieting, if not terrifying, for the victims. You know, huge amounts of things like anti-Semitic graffiti, people talked about, someone talked about getting like anonymous phone calls saying, "We know where your kids are." People are getting notes left on their cars. There's just a growing hostility to Jews all across Europe. All the stats are going in the wrong direction. The statistics from 2018 in France, anti-Semitic acts were up 74%. In the US, they doubled. In Germany, they're up 20%. Violent attacks were up 60%. The UK, for the last 3 years, each year there's been a new record set for the largest number of anti-Semitic incidents. And I wrote about this for the Trumpet print edition a few months ago. One of the biggest things that stood out to me writing on that one was just, you'd have Jews talking about, there was one particular couple, they'd moved from France to, I think it was Ashdod. So they moved to Israel, and you kind of, I don't know, we kind of think of Israel as dangerous, and I think wherever it was they moved, they were within range of missiles from Gaza and some of these things, but they just talked about how much safer they felt. They were just, it's so great over here. Our kids can go out by themselves after school, and we don't have to worry. We're so happy we moved. So it is really building to a genuine climate of fear, depending on where people live or where these Jews live in Europe.
What can you tell us about this alarming trend and just this, you know, seemingly a resurgence of anti-Semitism there in Europe in terms of Bible prophecy?
So there is, it's important to note that there is a spiritual dimension to this story. If you're a Bible believer, if you believe that the Bible is the word of God, you have to believe in a spirit world. You have to believe in a devil. You know, there's a lot of Christian groups that don't talk about that very much these days. I mean, there was even a Catholic archbishop who said he doesn't really exist. But the Bible makes very clear, you know, there's a devil. And the spirit world influences what we see in the physical world. And you can see from the Bible as well that Satan has a special hatred for the Jews. The Jews have a history with God. They have a fantastic future with God. And Satan, the devil, really does not like that. And so when you see attacks like this growing, when you see a growing climate of anti-Semitism, you're seeing his influence rising in the world, his influence rising in Europe. And so that's why this story is concerning, or just another reason why this story is concerning to everyone. I talked about this spiritual reality in the Trumpet Print article. It was in the September Trumpet Print pretty recently, and that article is called The One Minority Society Loves to Hate. If you read that, that goes through what the Bible says about this subject, what Bible reasons there are for Satan's hatred for the Jews, and then just the wonderful future that they have with God as well.
We'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes today. Thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll go back to Brent for an update on the Israeli elections.
So everyone will remember the elections that took place back in September 17th in Israel. And this was a repeat election, the first time that's happened first time it's happened ever. And it came out that both of the leading parties, that of Likud, which is led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and the second, the runner-up, Benny Gantz's party, Blue and White, neither of them were able to form a majority of 61 seats in the Knesset. And so there has been, over the past 4 weeks, this deliberation process, whereby some of them are protesting it, but a process whereby Netanyahu has decided to, well, he's been given the mandate by the president to go ahead and try and cobble together a coalition using the other parties to get to the 61 seats that he needs. As of today, 3 weeks in, he hasn't been able to achieve that, understandably so, as there is no way that the parties are going to succumb to him, and there's no way that parties are going to succumb to the second vote-getter, Likud's Benny Gantz, Blue and White's Benny Gantz. He is going to probably have the opportunity to try and form a government himself, and this involves basically going to the different parties and having backroom deals, trying to see what each party could get out of joining the coalition in terms of cabinet posts and things like that. But it doesn't look like that would be effective as well, meaning that after the next 2 weeks, so probably just after Sukkot, we might see the Israel deciding that it's impossible to form a government, and they may be going back to elections once again. So these elections would take place within the next 6 months. In the meantime, Benjamin Netanyahu would continue as prime minister. There have been a couple of options that would kind of prevent this from taking place, and that is some type of rotating premiership where Gantz's party and Likud, Netanyahu's party, come together, and Netanyahu's the prime minister for the first 2 years, and then he steps down and so on. Benny Gantz would take it for the next 2 years of the term. However, it doesn't look like Netanyahu's going to agree to that, just because there is a stipulation in there that if he is indicted on these cases of bribery that are against him right now by the Attorney General, which is due to come down the next couple of weeks, that he would have to step down from his post if he is indicted, which would put the hands of deciding who the Prime Minister is to the Attorney General in Israel, which is unelected and has already said that he doesn't like Netanyahu. So Netanyahu's probably not going to go for this. So it looks like we are at stalemate, at least for the future, the near-term future. And it looks like, barring some amazing compromise by one of these leaders, Israel will be heading back to a third election to try and find out if there's going to be any change in the electorate and how they vote, which again continues this process of deep division and deep instability, with each party blaming each party, each leader blaming each leader inside Israel, which can't be good for the strength of the nation of Israel.
Yeah, sounds like just a lot of division, a lot of political turmoil there. We'll be looking forward to the next update on that as soon as we have a read on what will happen next. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, for our next story, we return to Asia, where China is developing weaponry that could allow it to take out some of America's most important space-based technology. For this, we'll turn it back over to David.
So the newly formed U.S. Space Command leader, General John Raymond, came out saying that China is building some directed energy weapons, probably lasers, to blind our U.S. satellites. And that he basically was just warning that China's upping its abilities to disrupt our military capabilities and our technological capabilities by destroying our satellites. And we know that this is something that's ongoing and not necessarily a news story, but I think it's important to just remember how fragile this whole system of economy, technology, our military is. And Mr. Gelfler has written about the America Achilles heel and just stating that this is a very big point for us to just keep in mind about how quickly and how easy really the United States power can go down just from an attack on technology, and specifically in this case, the satellites.
Yes, actually going all the way back to 1995, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has been cautioning about just how dangerously reliant the U.S., its military in particular, is on technology. So we'll be sure to include a link in the show notes to his article, America's Achilles Heel and Germany, which places all of that in the biblically prophetic context. And we'll also include a link to a new article called China Prepares to Blind U.S. Satellites, which is up on thetrumpet.com right now. Thanks very much for that, David. For our final story today, we'll go to Scotland, where authorities are criminalizing a parent's ability to raise well-adjusted children. For this, we'll turn it back over to Rafaro.
The Scottish Parliament recently passed the Equal Protection Act, which, as the name infers, basically places spanking as in the same category as assault between adults. And it actually passed by a pretty large majority, 84 to 29 votes. You know, and the man who introduced the law, John Finney of the Green Party, commented on it and said that spanking is an unacceptable form of violence in any setting, which I think if you just look at that, if you just look at the mechanics of spanking itself and you think of what he's comparing it to, that already is just a dangerous indication of how people look at spanking in relation to raising their children. You know, it's being compared to assault, and it's being called a violent act, you know, and just think of the way that this resonates with all the parents and the children even who are being raised in such a place. And Scotland itself now has some of the strictest anti-spanking laws in the UK as a consequence of the passing of this law. And parents are actually quite disgruntled as a result of this law, because they feel that they are being told how to run their household and how to raise their children. And that is basically what this law does. It's the government reaching into people's homes and dictating how they raise their children, and essentially saying that if you're spanking your child, you're committing a violent act against your child, and that's something that is criminal, and you can't do it, and it's stopping parents from raising their children.
Richard, did you have any comments you wanted to make about this story?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think that's worth taking into account is that in the UK, there are already pretty rigorous laws on spanking to prevent abuse. You know, obviously, when we're talking about children being spanked and it being a beneficial thing and something parents need to do to raise well-adjusted children, we're talking about, you know, loving correction done in love, not out of anger, done carefully, in proportion to the offense, done so that it doesn't cause any permanent harm to the child. You know, something done very carefully. We're not talking about any kind of angry beating. And that kind of thing is already outlawed in the United Kingdom. You know, all kinds of spanking with an implement. I mean, it gets a little complicated where you are, but in general, that is already outlawed. So using anything other than the hand. So when they're talking about eliminating spanking, they're talking about totally eliminating all kinds of spanking, even something done relatively gentle with the parent's hand in love. You know, that even that they're saying you can't do, let alone kind of spare the rod, spoil the child. Even spanking with the hand, they're outlawing now.
Yes, exactly. And proper spanking is, like you said, Mr. Palmer, discipline in love, which will benefit a child for all their life, because children really do tend to make mistakes, you know, and the Bible says that foolishness is abound in the heart of a child. And the main purpose behind spanking is to make sure that any such foolishness is taken out of the child's mind and system while they are children, so that when they grow up to be model citizens. That is why the Bible does endorse spanking, like you said, and it comes from a place of love. As the Bible says, the father who loves his son corrects him, and that's what proper spanking does. And this law here that's been passed is just really trying to eradicate any and every single form of that happening.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Rifaro. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember to visit us at thetrumpet.com to read more about the stories we're discussing today. Please email any questions or comments you may have about today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, David Vigil, Rifaro Manyepa, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks also to Steve Herkus for engineering and production. And we'll leave you today with the words of Carl Sandburg. Time is the coin of your life. It is the only coin you have, and only you can determine how it will be spent. Be careful lest you let other people spend it for you. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.